This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Will China lead the world into a new ecological civilization, while America falls behind into the remnants of the old carbon age? Hidden by mainstream media, big changes are developing on the global stage. Our guest Lawrence Brom returns to give us a tour. Meanwhile, business as usual is setting us up for the awful shocks of climate disruption. Our second guest, Gernot Wagner, says our economies are heading into a series of hits, something he calls climate shock. A successful international trade lawyer helping multinational corporations enter Asia quits to find himself and the mythical Shangri-La. That journey becomes a book, and along the way, our guest finds a passion for restoring ancient buildings in China and Tibet. He founds an organization called the Himalayan Consensus, which, among other things, probably helped Nepal develop an economic vision and just recently their first secular constitution. These are among the many sides to Lawrence Brom. He's been listed as a senior advisor to China's Ministry of Environmental Protection. I was doubtful. I checked. It's true. When I talked with Lawrence in the spring of 2015 about his new book, Fusion Economics, he said China would come out with a bold new vision to move away from carbon-powered civilization, perhaps surpassing the United States. And that plan has been released. We'll talk about the developing bipolar world of international finance, real roads for climate sanity, and Lawrence's appointment as foreign policy advisor to Jill Stein, the Green Party's candidate for the presidential elections in 2016. Lawrence Brom, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. It's great to be back on your show.
You're kind of a fusion yourself. You talk to Greens about international finance and then businessmen about an ecologically survivable future. Why were you in San Francisco just last week?
Well, I was speaking at the Bay Area Council to tech CEOs because I really believe that we must bring together environmentalists, business and finance, civil society in the same room if we're going to go forward and we're going to do something about keeping our planet as our planet, that is. We're not going to be going anywhere else. The prognosis on climate change is very serious. We have, according to the scientists that I interact with, about a 50-50% chance as a human species to make it to the year 2100. And so we're really now facing a crisis. And the only way out of that crisis is to make it profitable for businesses to adopt renewable, efficient energy, water conservation systems, and to shift the economic paradigm. And I think we have to break through this view, this stereotype that the environment or protecting the environment is against business. I actually see that this is the next opportunity for technology, for all kinds of products, infrastructure overhaul, the creation of jobs from PhDs to master degrees, all the way down to the blue-collar worker in an integrated opportunity. And this is why we have to convene everybody together. We have to look at the environmentalists as your R&D, your civil society that are out there solving problems at the grassroots, real problems of community, trying to reinvigorate communities, trying to get them off the grid, decentralize energy, seek local renewable solutions as your innovators. And then we see business and finance to grab these opportunities and scale them so that they can actually have meaningful impact.
Well, now, talking about business and finance, in a recent English-language interview I saw with you on Chinese state television, and again in your book Fusion Economics, you talk about the developing split in the highest levels of international finance. Who are the players there, Lawrence?
Well, what you have now is the emergence in China with it's China, India, followed by Russia, who are the main players behind two key financial institutions that have emerged over the past year. One is the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, and the other is the BRICS Development Bank. Added to this is China's what they call the New Silk Road Fund. And there's also his announcement just a few weeks ago with President Xi Jinping at the United Nations of a South-South Cooperative Fund. And so what's being constructed is a parallel financial architecture to the traditional Bretton Woods institutions of World Bank, IMF, WTO. These institutions are being paralleled with those that are coming out of Asia. And the vision is very much that there needs to be infrastructure, connectivity, linkages, and that this must be driven with renewable efficient energy systems. And the countries such as India and China, their experience, these are the developing countries, their experience of coming out of poverty and underdevelopment is relative to the nations of Central Asia, other nations in South Asia, Africa, that are seeking to get out of impoverishment and seeking to develop. Very often, IMF, World Bank are applying conditions that are not relevant. They're not consistent with the needs of a country. They're based on ideology. They're based on theories that are cooked up in Washington. And they just don't click with people. And they are actually kind of an imposition in many cases. And so this approach has bifurcated our global financial architecture. And we see Europe. Many European countries have wanted to get involved and participate in the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank because they see that there is a global shift taking place. And with two financial systems really emerging, the next step is what will be the next reserve currency. And if that currency is the renminbi, which is China's currency, or a basket of currencies of developing countries that is, under a BRICS umbrella. I think this is work in progress now, but once there's a second reserve currency out there, then really we have a bifurcated global financial system. I think that's where things are going.
And I've been thinking about this, and I wonder if two competing systems develop, would that make the world economy less likely to experience a global crash? Or could it make the world a more dangerous place? What do you think?
Well, I think the reason for taking this course of action is because of the past financial crises. Asia learned from the 1997 Asian financial crisis that deregulation, extreme market fundamentalism can crash economies and can wipe out, generations of savings. And so the actions taken then in resisting the hedge funds and holding up and supporting the currency, the renminbi, against the advice of the IMF and World Bank, which basically flattened out Indonesia and Thailand and left these countries in a mess because they had to take the IMF medicine. China didn't do that. So when the 2008 financial crisis took place, there was what they called the Chiang Mai Initiative, where Asian countries got together and pooled their own monetary resources and said, okay, we're going to have a fund here to prop up our currencies, our markets. We're not going to be drawn into this thing. And that moved on to about, I think it was in 2012, July, the BRICS nations met in New Delhi, and there was what they called the Delhi Declaration, which said, square out, the quantitative easing is going to create global financial volatility. This is not a responsible approach. This is very irresponsible. It's a short-term measure. It's going to prop up key financial institutions in America to push this out into Europe. In the long term, is just incubating another financial crisis. And if the Western powers or Washington cannot lead, then we're going to have to go it alone. And that was the decision that really has led to a fast track for the establishment of these financial institutions, the BRICS Development Bank and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. So it's really, the developing nations and the developing nations, again, lead China, India, followed by Russia, saying we have to put together our own system because we can't rely on the old system, and that has kind of, reached the brink. And we all know there's another financial crisis incubating out there, and we have to be prepared for it.
It puzzles me when Americans talk about hostility to China. Almost everything Americans buy is made there. And despite selling some U.S. government treasury bonds, China's still the biggest creditor to the USA. That ever-expanding American government debt ceiling, indeed the operation maybe of the U.S. government, would not have been possible without Chinese investment, wouldn't you say?
Well, right now, there's investment coming from China into America there. The Alibaba listed in the U.S. markets. They're looking for further economic integration. I think that we have had a foreign policy that's hostile to China. It's hostile to Russia. It's ambiguous with India. We have, in many ways, incubated a lot of the animosity that's now being felt toward us. And I think that we have to get away from ideological bias in our foreign policy. We need to be looking more about economic cooperation. The announcement recently of the TPP, you've got 12 countries on board. If you look at the map of it, these are mostly nations that have been pressured by America. This is not bringing into the Asia-Pacific cooperation key players, Korea. It's not bringing China in. It's not bringing, you know, really the players that have to be in what would be an Asia-Pacific trade agreement. And then the next question is, why do we need multilateral umbrella agreements when actually more and more countries are going it alone, doing bilaterals? In a way, it has been perceived, whether correctly or not, but it is perceived as an isolation attempt on China, which has only fueled more paranoia and hostility on the other side. And so our approach is not working, and we need to recognize that. And it hasn't worked in it's not working in Asia. It's not working in the Middle East. It's not working in Russia. We need to sit back and have not only a new economic paradigm, a new foreign policy. And I really feel that if we try to use climate change cooperation and focus on the technologies that we have, we would be able to step out and have some soft power leadership. If we don't do that, frankly, China and Europe are pulling together very fast, and I've been part of that process, and they are going to lead on climate change, and it will be a new soft power, and we will be left behind again.
Yeah, you've said China's mainly cooperating with Europe on alternative energy and energy efficiency, while America stands on the sidelines. Where is American tech investment going instead? I mean, America has the R&D.
Well, we're spending most of our investment on social media and video games. And that is, you know, I say a lot of this is antique spyware that's been released in the market collecting information on people. And we list it. It's driven by the investment banks. It's driven by the fast money that can take, you know, a tech site, we so-called tech site, effectively a tech product, and really list it on its potential rather than its actual economic fundamentals. And it's really like trading soybeans. At the end of the day, nobody actually collects the soybeans and cooks them. And so it's all being traded into the future. It's all a potential. And it's really not putting R&D where it should be, which is in areas of healthcare, in areas of agriculture, water, and, of course, the environment, new renewable and efficient sources of energy. And that's where it's been going in Europe. And certainly China and Europe are in intimate cooperation on this. The work that I did with the Ministry of Environmental Protection as senior advisor in drafting a lot of this key sort of policy shift that China's undertaking, to be very frank with you, was funded by Europe. It was funded by the EU. And the reason why is they have the technology. In a country like Finland, they're building buildings that create their own energy through solar and renewable, other renewable means. And the technology is quite advanced. But when you're looking at countries in Europe of 4, 5, 6, 7 million people, and you look to Asia, in China, that's not even a district in most major cities, and the same with India. So if you bring that technology to China and you cooperate and you scale it with the needs of China, the costs drop incrementally. And then the next stage of this, aside from regridding China, which is now the largest carbon producer in the world, and dropping carbon in its totality, this is also the opportunity for Europe and China in cooperation to be exporting these technologies, not just to China, not just within China using them, but exporting them throughout the entire developing world as well as the developed world, North America. And with the emergence of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, BRICS Development Bank, the huge infrastructure investments that are envisioned now, running really from Russia through Eastern Europe, all across Central Asia, South Asia, right through to both North and South Korea. This is the vision. And you then look at what's going to be happening along the Swahili coast of Africa into Central Africa. If you're using renewable, efficient energy technologies that are now cost-effective because of this expansion, then you know, this is going to create a whole different world. It's a whole different megatrend that is happening, and we're standing on the sidelines, and our Congress can't even, you know, face the scientific phenomenon that climate change is real. It's a problem, and so we're missing the boat.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Lawrence Brohm. Well, Lawrence, as you know only too well, on April 25th of this year, China published a major new policy document, which I gather translate as Towards Ecological Civilization Policy. Please take a little time to tell us what's in this new policy statement.
Well, this policy statement really establishes five pillars for a transition in China. The first pillar being major infrastructure investments by the state in grid conversion. Some 70% of China's energy needs now are coal-based, and this is a huge source of the carbon emissions. And so it really means shifting that grid from coal, which is enemy number one, to other renewable sources, including nuclear. I know there's a huge debate on nuclear. I won't get into the debate. The decision that China's taken is it's the least of the two evils if it's coal and nuclear, so they're going to go that way. And there's going to be a massive rollout of all types of renewable solutions. Even with thin film solar technology alone, you could probably light up the entire western half of China using the ultraviolet light at higher altitudes, because much of the country is at a very high altitude, over much of it's over 2,500 meters above sea level. And so this really offers a huge, this is the sort of first pillar, huge opportunity for creating jobs, because the economic model that has made China an economic superpower is really based on fixed asset investment in, over time by the state. And that has, you know, it's really effectively a prolonged New Deal. And this is now an extension of that, but rather a repeat of the old infrastructure. It's regridding the old infrastructure with new renewable systems. The other pillar of this is credit fiscal policy to drive businesses into, first of all, adopting renewable efficient energy, and second, to manufacturing all the gizmos and gadgets that are needed to get there. And it extends into all areas. And I just use a very simple example. I use a solar watch. It's really fantastic. And if a tiny little watch can be driven by a solar panel, every single apparatus we think of, you know, our iPhones, our, you know, laptops, all of this can be done. But you need to give fiscal credit, you know, either tax rebates or deductions or lending opportunity to businesses to do that. And then you have also your third pillar is a complete rethinking of the GDP matrix. You know, China's been pushing high growth rates, but it's actually now the high growth rates that are creating political social fractioning in the country rather than the stability that they were seeking to achieve. And that's because high growth has created damage to agricultural systems, water systems, health systems, and these are now priorities. So the government is now going to start to promote officials not on the basis of the GDP in their regions, but on the basis of their environmental integrity, the health care benefits in the region, and also they're going to be doing an assessment of officials when they come into a region to take power and govern that region. They're going to basically do an accounting of all of the environmental natural assets. And when they leave that position, if the, you know, if the environment has deteriorated, they're not going to be promoted. And so this is a whole different take on GDP, which is a Bretton Woods, post-Bretton Woods measurement. And lastly, they're going to be doing red lines across the country. That's the fourth pillar, basically, in whole environmental areas that were open to mining before will be shut down and untouchable, including marine areas. And lastly, education. They're going to be investing a huge amount of money into R&D education, training up a whole new generation of youth that are going to be savvy with environmental technologies and will not only in terms of renewable efficient energy solutions engineering, but also in terms of finance, law, all the areas that are going to be attached to funding this environmental transformation. And, of course, a huge value campaign that will be run through the schools and through neighborhoods about conservation rather than consumption, actually shifting that paradigm. You know, Deng Xiaoping once said to get rich is glorious. I think what Xi Jinping is going to be saying is to protect the environment is glorious. It's going to be a real quantum shift.
Wow. Well, how does this new ecological civilization policy relate to the Chinese president's visit to America and the White House in September?
Well, I think at the White House, it was more of a courtesy visit. It doesn't seem that anything really came out of that. The American media kept talking about cap and trade, but cap and trade is really on the periphery of all this. When we talk about carbon trading, it's simply allowing polluters to continue polluting while someone who's not polluting is effectively saying you're using my airspace for a fee. This that while China's going to adopt regional carbon trading centers because there's a CDM mechanism already in place from years ago when China adopted the Kyoto Protocol, this is actually not the solution. It's on the periphery. It's the icing. The solution is going to be in actual grid conversion and seeking zero carbon solutions. And Xi Jinping spoke to the UN. He's effectively indicated this approach. He calls it ecological civilization. That's a Chinese way of saying sustainable development, but I think it's maybe more appropriately a way of saying environmental economics, which is what they're adopting. And it also announced a very large fund for South-South cooperation, which really means that China is going to be reaching out to much of the underdeveloped world, not only through the mechanisms of the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank and BRICS Development Bank, but actually through outright support for systems. And one of the key issues in the underdeveloped world is energy. If you look at sub-Sahara Africa, some 60% of the continent doesn't even have electricity at all. And the idea of having big energy solutions, I remember last year the World Economic Forum held a meeting in Abuja, Nigeria, and said, oh, we have to create OPECs for Africa, but that's not what Africans want. They want to have decentralized energy at the village level using, you know, solar and other renewable solutions that make sense and are easy to maintain and are cost-effective. And most important, that allow villages to build their own integrity as economic units rather than dragging everybody to the cities and creating this sort of Latin Americanization approach, which has been so stifling at the end for many countries which are seeking to get out of underdevelopment and get locked into a kind of poverty conundrum. So I think these are the approaches that Xi Jinping has put on the table. And, yeah, you know, China's now leading in so many areas. It is the new economic superpower, and if they keep pushing soft power rather than hard power, they're going to be there.
And where does that leave us with the Paris climate talks this coming December, and how might the Chinese developments affect other countries?
Well, I think it's going to be inspiring. I think that the answer out there is going to be that a large umbrella agreement, while sounding nice, is not the solution. The solution is going to end up with nations taking their own initiative and seeking zero carbon solutions. And, you know, one of the reasons why I decided to work with the Ministry of Environment on the proposal, this what's called Opinions Toward Constructing Ecological Civilization. That's a mouthful of words, but what it is it's this five-pillar approach to shifting from fossil fuels to renewables. Why I worked with them on this and initiated this thing 4 years ago was because I realized if China leads on environment, it's going to embarrass our Congress to do something. We've got to catch up. And China's going to be rolling this out at Paris at COP21. Other countries will be following. India's going to be following behind it. Before COP21, we're holding the Himalayan Consensus Summit in Kathmandu. South Asia, environmental leaders and business leaders will be there. And one of the key things on our agenda is going to be seeking zero carbon solutions. Why we're doing this in Kathmandu? Because Kathmandu suffered one of the worst earthquakes in recent times. Huge devastation. Why did that happen? The glaciers are melting. When snows and ice melt, water shifts, shears rock. It's affecting the climate. I mean, the underdeveloped nations are on the front line of getting knocked out by climate disruption. Let's stop calling it climate change, because it's beyond a natural phenomenon. It is human induced. It's climate disruption. And if China rolls out a broad platform for this that can actually show us how we can use business solutions, how it's an opportunity for business, for investment, and job creation to address our climate disruption issues and come up with new sources of cheap energy, if they can show us how to do that, then a lot of countries are going to jump on the bandwagon and follow with their own solutions. And we have the capability here in America to lead and not follow. So I really hope that, business leaders are there and they take up the lead. It's not something just to listen to politicians make long-winded speeches. We need the business and financial leaders to say, this is an opportunity. This is the next mega trend. China's got the game changer, and we've got to move on it.
Well, now you mentioned America. Let's talk about Donald Trump. No, wait, let's not, because in that maelstrom lost in the media somewhere, Jill Stein is trying to get America to see that ecological vision that we need to survive. How did you get involved with the Green Party presidential campaign?
Well, during my last book tour back here in America for Fusion Economics, I spoke at Seattle Town Hall and was approached by Green Party leaders and they actually like these ideas, particularly the idea of saying, look, environmental protection is not about hippies, hugging trees. It's about an opportunity to create jobs, to revive communities, to decentralize energy in communities. It's really a way to bring back America from the grassroots. And there is also, not so much inhibition about business. We need to change the fundamentals of business. We need to get business on board. And they like these ideas. And so they started to approach me. I've been working with them since. Jill Stein then had a very, long session with me during that last stay here. And since then, I've been working with her team on developing foreign policy positions on a host of issues. And we're planning to bring Jill to the COP21. Because really green parties across Europe, New Zealand, across the planet are coming together and saying, look, we have to come up with solutions. And these solutions are not saying don't make money, not anti-capitalist. They're saying, look, let us have business as unusual. Let's look at new opportunities. Let's evolve business. And let's solve problems of community. Let's create jobs, but let's do it through what we have going, environmental technologies, and scale those technologies in a rational way. And I think Jill's going to be a fresh voice in this campaign. I think that the media is giving way too much attention to Donald Trump. He would not be taken seriously anywhere else in the world. I hope he does not become packaged as a new Ronald Reagan. I think that we need to have voices out there that are rational and that are aimed at solving problems and not rhetoric and not anger, because that's not going to get us anywhere. And we can't go bashing other countries saying that our problems are caused by them, because they're not. They're caused by us. And we have to begin at home by re-engineering America and making it strong again. And that's going to have to come up from the community. And I think that's what Jill Stein stands for. She stands for community people. She's in Lexington, Massachusetts. And hey, that's where the American Revolution began. We need a new revolution, one of technology, environment, and new business and new values. Values that are going to be thinking about the integrity of the planet and understanding that all of our economic, social, environmental systems are integrated, thinking big and not myopic.
Yeah, I think if another Congress dominated by Republican climate deniers is elected in 2016, that really signals the end of an old age for the United States and perhaps the rise of a new age elsewhere in the world. What would your opinion be?
We have to shift now. We have to get out of the past. The Bretton Woods system has kind of run its course. We have had now a number of presidential administrations that have pushed shock therapy, globalization, the idea of not globalizing technology, not globalizing healthcare, not globalizing one financial system, which is actually creating sharp divides between rich and poor and eliminating the middle class. And none of these things are solutions. So we have to sit back and say, look, we can keep band-aiding or keep, dragging on the narrative. Or we can sit back and say we really need to have a major restructuring. I was lucky because I started working in China in the 80s. And as a lawyer, I was part of watching a country come out of what was a broken system, post-cultural revolution. Communism there did not work. And watch them shift into a new system. It's something that's a hybrid. It's a combination of a semi-socialist system, a semi-capitalist. It's a mixture. And, you know, it's pragmatism, like, say, fusion economics. It's just, you know, what works, let's move it to the next stage. Let's face the problem, let's solve the problem. If the solution creates a new problem, let's solve that too. And it's a very proactive approach. And I think that I'm not saying adopt the Chinese system. I'm just saying we've got to be recognize that, you know, these are the things that are not working, and we've got to fix them. And to sit back and say, oh, you're not patriotic, I think it's unpatriotic not to look at our problems and solve them. That is really hurting the nation and the people and the things that, you know, our ancestors fought and stood for. We've got to sit back and say, that system's not working. That system's not working. We're going to fix it. And do it proactively and not with antagonism. And I think that's what this new political agenda has to have. And that's why I've joined the Green Party presidential campaign as foreign policy advisor, because I hope to bring something to it. And we need a third party. We need to break this duopoly that is just really repeating the same thing, whether you're Republican or Democrat. More or less, it's the same game back and forth. We're not going to get anything different unless we start to look at new solutions. And that's got to bring together environment as a priority with business and finance, and stop having this siloed approach that everyone's working against each other. They're not. They have to work with each other.
We're going to have to leave it there. There's lots of exciting things to talk about. Where should people go to get more information about you, your books, and your ongoing adventures, Lawrence?
Well, I have a website, lawrencebrom.info, I-N-F-O. I spell my name LaurenceBrahm.info. Or you can look up HimalayanConsensus.org. That's the NGO that I established, and it's now working in many areas in South Asia, in Asia. And there's a sister organization, AfricanConsensus.org, which is taking the approaches of Himalayan Consensus and looking at how they can be, you know, evolved in the African continent. And more youth are actually driving that process now. It's really become a kind of youth forum. So those are three places that people can look and keep in touch with what I'm doing. And I'm always looking for fresh ideas from the grassroots, and I'll be spending much of 2016 looking at the solutions across America. So if anyone has a local solution, I want to look at it.
We've been talking with Lawrence Brom. He's a kind of green renaissance man, a former international lawyer, now author and advisor to governments. And, of course, I'll have links for everything we've talked about, really, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Lawrence, I appreciate you taking the time to keep us updated about all this.
Well, thank you for having me back on your show, and keep up the really great work.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Are you ready for climate shock? Your home probably won't burn down, so why bother buying fire insurance? Because it might. And that's part of a powerful new argument for climate action coming not from scientists, but from economists. Gernot Wagner is a lead senior economist at the Environmental Defense Fund. He also teaches at Columbia University. He advocates for market-based solutions for environmental problems. He's teamed up with Martin Weitzman, a Harvard professor of economics, to write a new book, Climate Shock: The Economic Consequences of a Hotter Planet. Gernot, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I think your book is unique by saying we could do more about climate change precisely because the science is still uncertain. How does that work?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. It's what we know is clearly enough to propel us to act. What we don't know, though, is where this stuff really hits home. At the end of the day, it is a risk management problem that we ought to be focused on here. And yes, it's the risk, it's the uncertainty that really ought to drive action now.
Scientists occasionally talk about fat tail risk. Now, what is that, and what's it got to do with climate change?
Fat tails is actually, turns out, the the scientific statistical term being used here. And what that really means is that there are low probability, high consequence events that will most likely, right, we don't know for sure, but likely define the final outcome. Right? Some might call it black swans, others call it, you know, life happens. Statisticians call it fat tails. And that, when you look at climate change and the implications of the science, is what makes it so costly.
Yes, I see. Nassim Taleb has endorsed your book. What is the relationship between the idea of a black swan that he made famous and your work?
Well, in some sense, climate shock is a black swan for the climate, right? Nassim Nicholas Taleb were focused on financial markets. Well, we use the exact same logic and look at climate change. In other words, it is those low probability. They are low probability, right? We can't say that it is likely that these extreme events are going to happen, but they are such high impact that even a relatively low probability has enormous consequences.
Well, I know that official estimates for the amount of warming we will see this century alone go from a couple of degrees all the way beyond 6 degrees C or 11 degrees Fahrenheit. Those are shocking possibilities, and I guess you're saying we should plan for that possibility.
Exactly, right? So on average, well, let me put it this way. On average, things are going to be very, very bad. And the feature of talking about averages is, well, 50% of the time you're too high, 50% you're too low. But what we are really focused on is not the average number at all. We are looking at, so what's the chance of a true planetary catastrophe. And the way we define it in the book is, right, everyone talks about 2 degrees centigrade as a threshold not to be crossed. We look at 6 degrees. There is no mistaking 6 degrees as nothing other than a planetary catastrophe, right? You could have arguments what 2 degrees is, or maybe 3 degrees, 4 or 5, and or 6 is so far out there for a global average warming eventually that no one would mistake this as anything other than a planetary scale catastrophe. Now, we look at that 6 degrees centigrade, run the numbers, and come up with a chance of eventual global warming exceeding 6 degrees of at least around 10%, unless we act, right? There's always that attached too. It is always unless we, in fact, take the kind of action that scientists, economists, environmentalists, everyone else for that matter, at this point is talking about that we ought to be taking to avoid global warming.
Well, we can say, well, 10%, that's not much of a chance, but if you and I were playing Russian roulette and we had a gun with 10 chambers in it and one has a live bullet, we'd take it much more seriously, I think.
That's exactly the point, right? So 10% isn't in fact likely, right? It is likely that we will not exceed the 6 degrees average global warming for the planet. And that's good news, of course, because 6 degrees is like you. I like the Russian roulette analogy. Right? That's exactly it. A 10% chance of losing everything is pretty darn high.
It is indeed. Now, you know, often at the end of our interview, I end up asking, well, what can the individual do? But I'd like to bring that right up front, as you do in your book. In an article published in Salon magazine last March, you suggested our individual action may be pointless. It doesn't really matter if we recycle or even if we vote. Gernot, what were you really talking about there?
Well, as usual, right, there's a twist there. It's not saying don't recycle, don't vote. It's saying recycle well, vote well. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, it turns out that as economists, right, we are sort of trained to believe that there are trade-offs. And I'd like to think it's not just the bias economists have. Life is full of trade-offs, right? You can't always get what you want, basically. Well, when you look at these trade-offs, right, and when you look at limited attention spans, limited time, limited money, we ought to choose how we spend our resources very, very wisely. If we misspend them on interventions, on actions that don't get us the biggest bang for the buck, well, we are wasting money, we are wasting time, we are wasting resources. So that's really what we mean by, right, recycling well, voting well. Or in other words, do those things, right? I do them too, right? I'm vegetarian, I don't have a driver's license, I do all these things. And we all should be doing them, of course, but frankly, only if they also lead to more. to the kinds of action, to the kinds of climate action that is truly necessary.
Yeah, I sense your frustration with people who think themselves pretty green because they've got a cloth bag or they use a bicycle, and then they don't look at what that last plane trip just did to the atmosphere.
That's the point, right? That's part of the point. And frankly, I'm in that boat, right? I bike everywhere. I don't use plastic bags as much as I can avoid them. And at the end of the day, well, then I refuse the plastic bag at the checkout counter and I walk my takeout onto a plane, right? So it's that on the individual level. But of course, really what we ought to be concerned about is that kind of misguided action, if you will, on the societal level, right? So when we do public policy and we focus on, okay, what is truly necessary here, it takes much, much more than recycling, right? Sort of newsflash, recycling isn't going to solve global warming. Okay, so what will, right? And what will, of course, is the large-scale changes to the way we do business that are necessary here. And what that takes, frankly, is pricing CO2.
All right. Now, you and Weitzman pinpoint four barriers that make climate change action, like you just suggested, a lot harder. Could you tell us about a couple of those barriers?
Climate change, in many ways, is the perfect problem. Right? It is global, by definition, global warming. It is long-term. It's, in many ways, more long-term than many other climate public policy problems out there. It is uniquely irreversible in many ways, at least in human timescales, and it is extremely, extremely uncertain. Right, so now you put the four together, uniquely global, uniquely long-term, uniquely irreversible, uniquely uncertain, and you have what you can only describe as the perfect problem. So how do you, what do you do with that? Well, first of all, right, that's what makes tackling climate change so difficult. It also means that really what's necessary here is systemic change, right? Systemic thinking. It's the overall system that ought to change here, not just sort of individual pieces on the margin. We have to fundamentally rethink the way we are doing business.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Gernot Wagner, co-author of the book Climate Shock. One thing I'm just still asking myself about your book, looking into a dystopic future where we don't do anything, or certainly not enough to curb emissions, you predict the rich of this world will survive and the poor will not. Why is that?
Well, unfortunately, this is, as usual with most problems, right? The rich will adapt. The poor are the one who truly suffer, which, of course, doesn't make this any easier, right, to tackle, because, frankly, in many ways, the rich are the ones who have the most power when it comes to defining policy. And once again, that's what makes climate change yet again so a difficult problem. Right? It is us here in the rich world today who are causing most of the problem, while it's the poor future generations somewhere else who are going to suffer the most.
Well, I generally agree with you, but you know, it also occurs to me that the wealthy, and that includes many of us here in the developed world, have become totally dependent on a big system that is fragile. Isn't it possible with a big storm or a climate breakdown, we could be helpless and confused when the grid goes down, our iPhones don't work, the electricity goes off, but a subsistence farmer in a remote mountain village might not even notice?
Sure, right. So I'm not saying that the rich will not be affected by climate change. Of course not, right? Just because you have the money to buy a second air conditioner doesn't mean that it doesn't cost you money. Of course, right? We will all be experiencing the consequence. But, I mean, there too, right, up to a point. I mean, this is not pushing it to extremes, right? But when you see that Hurricane Sandy is about to hit New York and you have a private jet waiting for you in another house somewhere else, well, you are not going to be as affected by Sandy as the person in a third-floor, one-bedroom walk-up who has nowhere else to go. And, by the way, that person, right, still lives in New York. So that person isn't necessarily truly poor here, just relatively poor to the guy who jets off with his private jet and brings himself to safety. But still, right, of course, it is in fact a problem that affects all of us. And in many ways, in monetary terms, of course, the rich are going to be hit more because, by definition, they have more assets, more capital, more money at stake here.
So you offer some steps to deal with the climate crisis, and it starts with the unlikely one of that we should scream. What are you talking about?
Well, a three-point plan, essentially, if you will, how you can have an impact. And step one is scream, in fact. And yes, it is scream for the right policies. Right now, in some sense, it goes back to recycling well, or voting well, right? It's scream well, right? Scream for the right kind of policies. But that's sort of the point, right? This is a crisis. This is not a topic that we can push off onto future generations or not deal with in the proper way now. And frankly, in many ways, well, you can only scream for the right policies at this point. Now, that's not to say, right, that in fact is the only possible thing you could be doing, right? Screaming in many ways is the short here for, well, screaming for the policies, putting the kinds of policies in place that will in fact make a difference here.
And every time, Gernot, there's a big storm like Hurricane Katrina or Sandy in New England, politicians promise we'll rebuild things just the way they were. Insurance companies are ready to fund people to build their houses right where they were along the coast. Why is that so dumb, and what could we do better?
Well, the problem in many ways is, right, so we are rebuilding in the flood zones in the kinds of areas that are going to be hit more or worse in the not-too-distant future. We're already experiencing this, of course, right? New York City was already hit by 200-year storms within 2 years, right? And yes, in many instances, we basically go back, rebuild, and even subsidize essentially moving houses or building houses, building infrastructure in areas where they clearly ought not to be built. That is misguided policy if there ever was one.
All right, so your major solution is to put a price on carbon, and I wonder how that formula works when right now in the real world we're subsidizing fossil fuels instead of taxing them.
Yes, right. So the frustrating bit is, right, we're not even getting the sign right at this point. When you look at the $500 billion worth of fossil fuel subsidies and average that out, the average ton of CO2 we are currently emitting is subsidized to the tune of $15. So it's not so much a debate of what the right price is. We know that the price has to be positive. That's not a secret. We know it has to be at least $40 per ton of CO2 when you look at the U.S. government's calculations of what each ton of CO2 emitted today causes in terms of damages over its lifetime in the atmosphere. Meanwhile, we are going in the opposite direction.
Our guest on Radio EcoShock is Gernot Wagner, author of Climate Shock. Why not talk to us about the comparison between divesting from tobacco and divesting from fossil fuels?
That's an interesting analogy, right? So what you can actually do, point one was scream. Point two, we have cope. Point three, not a surprise when you look at two economists writing a book, is profit. Now, of course, it's not profiting from climate change. It's profiting from the kinds of policies and the kinds of changes that ought to be put in place in order to avoid the problem in the first place, right? Or in other words, it's looking at something like solar energy decreasing by 80% in the last 5 years, the cost of solar energy decreasing by 80% in only 5 years, and looking at what that means. Well, how can you profit from that, right? Now, when you look at the analogy to tobacco and essentially the regulatory risk, if you will, to investors not recognizing that there is a problem, that analogy is pretty strong. In other words, it's not a question of if we do the right thing eventually. It's a question of when we're actually getting around to pricing carbon properly. Well, for tobacco, it's pretty much the same thing, right? There's no chance that, let's say, New York is going to sort of stop banning cigarettes in certain areas. If anything, those bans are only going to get tighter, right? They're going to be more ambitious. Well, in other words, the risk, the regulatory risk, only points in one direction. Well, same for CO2, same for greenhouse gas. So in other words, as an investor, as a business, as anyone looking at this problem sensibly, you can only look at things pointing in one direction. And there, the question is, if we as policymakers, the public, are going to make the right decisions on time, right? Not if, when.
Now, if climate policy continues to fail, I wonder if we'll see a bubble in valuations for startups in geoengineering, and are you in favor of geoengineering?
To answer your second question, no, I'm not in favor of saying let's look at something like geoengineering as an alternative in any way, shape, or form. What I am in favor of, what I think we ought to be doing, is look at geoengineering risk mitigation as a topic of potential research analysis that clearly ought to be taken seriously. And frankly, clearly ought to be taken seriously in one, for one important reason. So this is when we as economists look at geoengineering. It looks like it has the exact opposite properties as the climate problem in the first. In other words, right, why are we in this mess to begin with? Well, because it takes coordinated action by lots and lots of people, or at least governments, to make a difference here. And that action is costly. Well, it's not a free lunch, right? It might be cheap. It's a lot cheaper to do something about climate change than not to, but still, it's not a free lunch either. Well, when you look at geoengineering, in particular solar radiation management, term, right, shooting sulfates into the stratosphere to create this artificial sun shield to cool the planet, well, first of all, no, that's not a solution. It is not a replacement for decreasing CO2 emissions. It can't be. But it does have one important property. It is really, really cheap to do. We are talking millions of dollars, maybe tens of millions of dollars, as opposed to billions of dollars globally in order to have a quite significant impact. So in other words, you're looking at the exact opposite properties of climate change. And there, too, you are not looking at if we are going to see action like that at some point. In many ways, it's a question of when, precisely because it is so cheap.
Now, thinking of the many members of Congress who deny that humans are causing climate change or that it's important if we are, I wonder if they get elected just because the public really doesn't want to give up all the benefits of fossil fuels. I'm not sure that I do. I like to drive around, you know, to get somewhere as opposed to being stuck within the radius that I can walk. That's a tough, tough problem to solve for a democracy.
It is. Now, of course, what we do see already is significant action, even if you're in the U.S., right? Even in the U.S. where you, like you said, right, many, many members of Congress deny that the problem even exists. Well, the majority no longer does, and especially the majority of the public recognizes that it is a problem and that we have to act. And yes, right, it is not an easy one to tackle because it affects so much of what our civilization is built on.
And you talk about the great unknowns of climate change as risks to be tamed, and inevitably we interviewers always fall into the trap and we say, well, what are the unknowns? And I know we don't know, but climate scientists have been able to predict some of the worst outcomes, and you've written about some of those scenarios in your book. What sorts of things are you talking about? Can you give us some clues?
Well, let me put it in sort of Don Rumsfeld terms, right? Our U.S. Secretary of Defense, former Secretary of Defense, is famous. Dictum around invading Iraq, right? There are known knowns. There are known unknowns, right? Stuff that we know about. We just can't quantify, right? We don't know when it's going to hit. And then there are the big unknown unknowns. Now, to answer your question, right? No, I can't tell you what the unknown unknowns are. We simply don't know, right? That's, of course, the point. Now, for the known unknowns, we do, in fact, have pretty good indications, at least a sign of where these are going to go. And unfortunately, right, that's the kind of stuff that puts the shock into climate shock, because the sign of the vast, vast majority, if not all, of these known unknowns points in one and only one direction. In other words, the problem is much, much worse than we currently know to be the case.
Well, maybe you've just answered my next question, because I doubt that humans will act until irreversible climate change has already taken hold. Some say we're already there. Laying aside your role in the Environmental Defense Fund, where do you personally fit on the scale of doom to optimism?
Well, I'm certainly on the optimistic side when it comes to us now finally recognizing that this is such a significant problem and beginning to take the right actions. Are we on a path to solving climate change as we speak? Well, no, clearly not yet. Frankly, like solving is a funny term here anyways, right? Because, like you said, there are already many, many consequences of climate change that we feel today already. Clearly, it's a matter of mitigating the risk here, decreasing the risk, minimizing the risk, if you will. Solving the problem is out. That said, am I optimistic that we are actually going to take the right actions? Yes, absolutely. Mainly because when you look at the actual forces now on the ground and when you look at the things happening at the policy level, whether it's here in the U.S., in states like California, even in Washington, right? The Obama administration, just this past August, put in place the Clean Power Plan. For the first time, we now have limits, we're going to have limits, on CO2 emissions from coal-fired power plants, both newly built power plants and existing ones. That's an amazing step in the right direction, and it is exactly these kinds of actions that we are seeing more and more of.
Is there anything I've missed now or a parting message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
This is, in fact, a solvable problem, right? Climate change is difficult. It's extremely difficult to tackle. In many ways, it's the perfect problem. But when you look at what's happening in state capitals so like Sacramento here in the U.S., or in capitals like Beijing, right? China right now is experimenting with 7 regional cap and trade systems. So China is putting some of the right policies in place. Here in the U.S., we are looking at policy after policy pointing in the right direction, right? They don't yet add up to enough, but the momentum is clearly there. So yes, I am in fact optimistic that we can tackle this problem and frankly do it in our lifetimes.
We've been talking with Gernot Wagner. He's the lead senior economist at Environmental Defense Fund, along with Harvard economist Martin Weitzman. He's published the controversial book Climate Shock, The Economic Consequences of a Hotter Planet. And I've been waiting to hear about those for a long time, so I'm glad we had this chance to talk. You can find out more at climateshock.org and get links to YouTube videos with Gernot in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thanks so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I think we've covered the 50 Shades of Doom pretty well lately on Radio EcoShock. Next week, we'll start a short series for change, looking for solutions. I've got the best from the recent permaculture convergence in the UK in September, plus custom interviews of major players by Albert Bates. Stay tuned for those who are planting the future. As always, thank you for listening and for caring about our world. We need love.